everyone, we're back. Welcome to Risky Business number 268, the first edition of the show for 2013. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by our good friends at Adobe. And Adobe's Director of Product Security and Privacy, Brad Arkin, will be along a little bit later on with an update on the Phantom Zero Day saga the company experienced last year, as well as filling us in on some efforts underway at Adobe to combat spear phishing attacks that use dodgy flash objects embedded in Office files. And that is actually more interesting than it sounds. This week's feature interview is with Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd. These guys run outsourced bug bounty programs. It's a fantastic idea and one that I personally think will really take off over the next couple of years. But first up, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Adam Boileau. And Adam, first up this week, I missed you.
Yeah, it's been interesting, actually. Like, people have been pasting me all sorts of news links over the holidays going, oh, what do you think Pat's going to think of this? Well, I don't know. Pat's off surfing. I don't think he thinks about it at all.
I didn't. I really didn't. In fact, China was busy owning pretty much everything. And you know what I had to say about that?
What did you have to say about that?
Absolutely nothing. It was pretty good.
It's the sound of Oracle responding to a Java vault.
Silent. All right, well, enough of this. Let's get to the serious business.
serious Chinese business.
Yes, well, apparently New York Times, Washington Post, Twitter, Department of Energy, like everyone's getting owned. No surprises there. But everyone's blaming China, and it's like it's become just such a response that because everyone's blaming China, people are starting to go, well, come on, they can't be behind everything.
No one would, you know, an Intel agency would never take the tradecraft of another Intel agency and pretend to be them. That would never happen.
No.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, these attacks have made some pretty big news. I mean, especially New York Times and Twitter and apparently Washington Post is like, well, the Chinese are still hacking us. We're still getting pwned.
Yeah. You know, the New York Times one, it was certainly pretty interesting. I mean, I think that that stood out for me with this particular attack, and it's been written up all over the place, I guess, really is sort of the sheer hubris of it. Right. The you know, this attack appeared to be targeted at breaking into the New York Times so that they could figure out who the sources were for a New York Times article that was, you know, critical of Wen Jiabao, the premier of China, and saying that he was corrupt and, you know, stealing billions of dollars from the Chinese economy, which I'm sure would totally never happen. But yeah, they were interested in finding the sources. And like, that just seems like, you know, if you're going to, you know, I know cyber attacks are cheap, right? And I know it doesn't take a lot of expertise to do it, but it really does seem like not a very big thing to, well, I guess to me, to blow, you know, in this case, what, 45 different pieces of custom malware on? It just seems like a lot of effort to go to out, you know, a journalist who is saying nasty things about them. And you say nasty things all the time and no one's hacking your stuff.
I do say nasty things all the time. But I think, I mean, maybe they were trying to find a source who was feeding them intel. I mean, that's, to me, that strikes me as a pretty sophisticated, like, you know, leak identification program. You know, they're looking for a senior source, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so, but I don't know. It just seemed like, you know, when you could be stealing the plans for the, you know, F-35 or...
They've already got them, man. Now they're after the snitches who are crying and wah-wah-wahing to the New York Times. Graft that. There's no corruption in communism. At least you and I know that.
Sadly, I guess you're right. They've already stolen everything of value and now they're just, you know, taking the, you know, the fittings off the taps.
But you got to love it. You know it's 2013 when you've got Rupert Murdoch tweeting from his verified account, Chinese still hacking us or were over weekend. End of message. I love it.
Truly, the dystopian future has absolutely arrived, hasn't it?
Yeah, when Murdoch himself.
Richard Murdoch's rolling into the response on Twitter.
Exactly. Now, apparently the Department of Energy was compromised in some sort of sophisticated attack. What's interesting, though, is the Department of Energy in the United States, as far as I know, is the government department that looks after the nuclear weapons silos and complexes.
Well, yeah, and of course also they're responsible for Sandy National Labs, where, you know, allegedly Stuxnet came from, in that they have a, you know, a big research center that does lots of things with SCADA and control system security. Mm. And, you know, if anyone were that's going to work on the payload for Stuxnet, they'd work there. So that's kind of a, you know, I guess brings things nicely full circle, unless it's the Iranians pretending to be the Chinese, in which case it would be absolutely full circle.
Maybe it's someone from Liechtenstein just having a laugh.
Perhaps.
Who knows? But some, yeah, really, I mean, do French we know dude. Much about what sort of info got snagged? I mean, what was being targeted, anything?
No, there's not really a whole bunch of information. I mean, they're saying that it was, quote, personally identifiable information, you know, like driver's licenses and social security numbers and all the boring things that they already have, which, you know, if you own the DOE, you know, presumably that would not be the thing that you were going to exfil. You know, it doesn't seem that useful. I mean, obviously you can target, you know, social engineering and phishing, and, you know, there are things you could use that for, and maybe that's just what was available. But, you know, that just smells of not having finished the incident response process or not wanting to talk about it to me.
Now, of course, the fact that Twitter got ran into a bit of trouble, we've mentioned that already, but the number of users affected was 250,000. 250,000 passwords are compromised, 250,000 accounts compromised, which seems like a lot, but they've got 250 million users. So,
well, yeah, and half of them are bots, and, you know, the other half are you know, people who've forgotten their passwords or something. Yeah, but, yeah, it's not, you know, yeah, in terms of active user base, that doesn't seem like a huge amount. But yeah, really, anything that can target Twitter, given how important Twitter is in the, you know, modern hipster communication ecosystem, you know, I guess is still a useful thing for an attacker.
And, you know, we just saw the Super Bowl over there in the United States, and the I mean, that was, you know, during which I think HB Gary got owned on Super Bowl weekend, you know, a couple of years ago. And it turns out this year it was the Federal Reserve's turn. Federal Reserve Bank in the US was apparently briefly hacked.
Yeah, so briefly hacked is a funny thing, isn't it? It's kind of like, I guess, like a little bit pregnant or something.
Half pregnant, but, yes.
But apparently some anons found some box that had a, you know, mailing list or contact details for, you know, bank execs and dropped that on the paste bins or something. Which, yeah, like, not a world-ending hack, but still, I like the headline, briefly hacked.
Hmm.
I guess it didn't take long.
Now, look, we've just spoken about mass pwnage, chaos, you know, cyber blood running down the information superhighway.
Yeah, right? Tubes are awash with the corpses of thine enemies.
But rest assured, because the US government is on top of it, because the Pentagon's cyber command apparently is going to expand fivefold. I'm sleeping better already.
Yeah, I mean, I know I, for one, feel that, you know, expanding the size of the military will make me feel a lot better in cyberspace. Like, no one is going to show me a nasty picture on the internet with the US Cyber Command on watch. It's just, you know, I feel much better.
Oh, now in absolutely shocking news, there've been some bugs in Java.
Yeah. Our chums at Oracle decided that they would do us all a really big favor and just, you know, ever so slightly accelerate their updating of Java because of, like, the 50 remote 0-day that are currently available. Some of them being exploited in the wild, of course. So yeah, they patched all of those. It's going to make no difference whatsoever. There'll be another 50.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bottomless pit. It's like this multi, you know, it's like a four-dimensional space, Java, where you can just pull unlimited bugs out of it. I think there's more bugs than actual code. I mean,
it's a hypercube of fail is what that is.
Hypercube of fail, indeed. Now, Apple has, okay, so you got to help me clear this up, because I've been seeing a couple of stories around over the last couple of weeks that say, you know, we know that Apple blocked Java plugins in browsers some time ago, but it looks like, what, they've now blocked Java runtimes and then unblocked them, or have they just re-blocked Java in the browser? I mean, it's very confusing, but apparently Apple made some sort of change through an update through its malware protection service that blocked a whole bunch of Java applications from running. It's causing a bunch of businesses out there a really serious problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% clear, not being an active Mac user, exactly to what extent they've been breaking it. But I mean, the root here obviously is that Apple has decided to treat Java runtimes, you know, like malware, which, you know, is not an unreasonable thing to assert, you know, given that everybody's getting owned. But yeah, obviously, if you're using Java, you're relying on it for your business, you know, having a core part of your operating system just kind of magically disappear because somebody thinks it's a risk to you, right? That's a choice that you need to be able to make or unmake yourself, not necessarily on Apple's whim. And I can absolutely see how people are a little bit cranky about this. I mean, especially given that, you know, they're turning it off, turning it on, depending on, you know, what Oracle are up to in any given week.
Yeah, so you're unclear as to whether or not this is a runtime thing or a browser thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's browser only, you know, just applet then browser only, or whether it's like they're turning off the whole runtime for the platform.
Now, Microsoft and Symantec apparently have ripped the crap out of a click fraud botnet that was generating a lot of revenue for its owners. They're going to be spewing.
Yeah, I didn't realize quite how much money and how big this particular click fraud botnet was. It was a piece of malware that would essentially jack your search results and then, based on what you were searching for, generate fake pages with content from, you know, the people they were attempting to direct ad clicks towards. And they were making fairly reasonable money out of it. You know, some, you know, like six, seven figures sort of amounts, which is, you know, that's quite a lot.
If you knew that much about like dynamic content generation, search engines, and, you know, just general coding, you would think that you might actually be able to make your money legitimately. You know what I mean? There's a point where some of these scams become so complicated. I'm like, you would have needed investment. You would have needed seed money to get this started. Why not do something legit? Why not do something square? Why not?
Well, exactly. You're right. Like, I mean, the complexity of building this kind of distributed system. And,
yeah. You know, build an iPhone app. Around it. Come on. Be an entrepreneur.
Really, yeah, you could.
Move to San Francisco. Drive a nice car. I don't know. It just seems weird. Anyway, now moving over to Wired's excellent threat level blog, and newsflash, there's a lot of vulnerable Android devices on attached to wireless carriers.
Yeah, this is some fresh news right here. Although it is, you know, it's nice to see this story written up. You know, not, I guess well, it's not really mainstream press, but you know, nice to see it written up in a way that really I think captures the crux of the problem, which is that, you know, Google are doing a pretty reasonable job of trying to keep up with the problems with Android. You know, they're rolling out patches responsively and, you know, upgrading the things that they can, but there is just no incentive to push out those updates, you know, through the vendors and through the carriers and down to the end users. And, you know, it doesn't really matter how fast Google patch it if people aren't actually getting that. And it correctly identifies the root cause as, you know, kind of business model things rather than a technical challenge. And, you know, this is a very real problem for everybody who uses Android.
Well, it's funny, actually, because the guy who's like, the reason this is in the news at the moment is there's a guy from the ACLU who's their technology and policy analyst, right? His name's Chris Segoyan. And he was the guy who started writing up those things last year, like saying about how O-Day sales should be banned and it's all really evil and, you know, like detrimental to consumers and stuff. And like in the case of that stuff, it seemed to me dude did not get it at all, right? He just sort of seemed like, you know, the way that the right wing would stereotype the ACLU guys as being like completely out of touch, ranty, ravey types. It was sort of staying true to type on that. But this guy now, I mean, it seems like this guy, like once he gets an issue, he runs with it. And now he wants wireless carriers to patch their Droid devices.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Chris Sohoyan, you know, there's a lot of people in the industry, you know, especially in the vuln research area that, you know, don't have a whole bunch of time for him. But, you know, I think, you know, he often does have a point, right? And he's not, he was a guy behind one of the, there was like a boarding pass thing that he made fun of the TSA over a couple of years ago, and that was quite a valid thing to talk about at the time. And you know, he does, you know, I think have a reasonable grasp on the issues. I don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but in this particular case, yeah, I think he's bang on the money, and this is the sort of thing that really could use some input from something like the ACLU, I think.
Conveniently, yeah, you know, in this instance, our positions align quite nicely.
Yeah, conveniently.
So we like you this week, but when you start banging on about how 0 day should be outlawed next week, we're not going to like you again.
Yeah, certainly there are some problems with that particular item.
Yes, there are some minor issues. Now, Phil Zimmerman, you know, very well known in crypto circles as the, you know, creator of PGP, you know, big supporter of PKI and whatnot. He has been quoted. He was doing a talk at a Kaspersky conference over in Puerto Rico. And he's all like down with PKI now, and PKI sucks. And, you know, governments can subvert the actual I bit of the PKI. So, you know, we're moving to two-way crypto and, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, well, I think this is if you're interested in actually using cryptography, which clearly, you know, Phil Zimmerman is, and using it in a way that really does do what it's supposed to do, then, you know, no one could argue that PKI hasn't been a failure, you know, from that respect. So, you know, I think the fact that he's saying this is good, and obviously the stuff that Silent Circle have been doing to try and provide, you know, crypto systems that can be used by end users in a, you know, robust and secure manner is, you know, is very, very cool work.
Well, he's talking about the holy grail here being crypto that cannot be intercepted by government, even when they, you know, even when they can subpoena keys from third parties. So if you're using this stuff, you're okay. Government can't get access to it.
Yeah.
Which was the idea behind PGP in the first place in the 90s.
Well, exactly. And I mean, to a large respect, PGP is still in that place, right? Because of the ad hoc PKI rather than centralized PKI infrastructure. You know, PGP still works, as far as I'm aware, anyway. Hi, everybody at Fortmead. As far as I'm aware, it still works pretty well. And so, you know, building on that legacy and you know, extending that kind of capability elsewhere, I think, is a good thing.
Now, speaking of crypto, staying on crypto, and everybody's favorite showboat, Kim.com has offered a 10,000 euro reward. I mean, that's confidence. For breaking the crypto system used with his new service offering, Mega.
Yeah. The one thing you gotta admire about old mate Kim, right, is like clearly whoever gives him public relations advice is amazing. Like, it's wag the dog, great good.
Because they're probably some ex-North Korean, you know, master manipulator. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, like, what was the Iraqi communications minister, like the one who was...
Their stomachs will boil in fires of hell, that guy.
Yeah, that guy. Like, clearly he's on the case, because, old Kim hasn't made a single misstep in the public eye.
But I love how he's dressed it up as, like, we're so confident in our crypto. Now, first of all, dude is loaded, right? Second of all, the reward is only 10,000 euros, which is, like, pretty much call, right?
Yeah, for, you know, versus a real pen test or a real security review,
exactly.
Certainly a crypto arc review. It's
so this guy is laying it down like, oh, damn, I'm confident. I'll give you 10 grand if you can beat it. But really, this looks like cheap QA.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is.
It's multi-level awesome. The dude, he's a shonky dude, but this is genius.
Yeah, well, exactly right. I mean, the guy is a knobhead for sure, but yeah, like he's playing everybody very, very smoothly, and yeah, it's good stuff. Most entertaining.
Speaking of playing people very smoothly, there's been I don't often pick out stories like this, but there's been a really awesome little attack against Yahoo Mail accounts that's linked to a WordPress vulnerability, and it's just a really, really clever way of owning these accounts, Adam.
Yeah, so there's been this attack that's going around where essentially it was a combination of like a phishing attack with some cross-site scripting, and it ended up, you had a cookie theft via a very old WordPress instance that was somewhere in, .yahoo.com that had access to cookies for yahoo.com. Plain old-fashioned reflected XSS in WordPress being used to then steal session cookies for Yahoo Mail instances, which was then being used to harvest address books and then send, this phishing attack onwards via the content stolen from the address book, which, seems like a lot of work for that. But
it does, but you've got to admire them. The fact that the attack worked, you're just like, damn.
Yeah, no, and it's a great example of why, loads of little vulnerabilities, like, reflected cross-site scripting, for example, like, oh, alert one, the end of it. Actually using these things in combination like this, really can, leverage up some great attacks. I mean, the Sammy worm on MySpace and all those sort of things. Like, really, it's a great example of the death by a thousand cuts problem that is modern web.
But way to get complicated with it, man. Way to get complicated with you, like, web bug chaining.
Yeah.
for what exactly? But there's a lot of bored people out there. Now a bunch of serious vulnerabilities have been disclosed in some software. It's like control system software that runs like building automation, security systems, access systems, elevators, stuff like that. That's not good.
No, it's really not. Although, I mean, let's face it, it's not exactly news that there's vulnerabilities in industrial control systems. But in this particular case, a couple of researchers, Billy Rios and Terry McCorkle, have been doing some work on the Tritium Niagara AFX framework, which is, it's a SCADA, industrial control systems thing. Anyway, they got like remote pre-auth and then privilege escalation. So you just remotely route these things. And of course, you're not supposed to, in theory, you're not supposed to put these things on the internet. But, the reality is that if you build an IP connected control system, someone's going to put it on the internet. And, all you have to do is go and ask Shodan or low-hanging Kiwifruit and, shake that tree and a whole bunch of stuff falls out. So this is bad, the vendors for this stuff, like, they really need to get with the program and start shipping things that are actually safe to be used on the internet, because people are.
Yes, you're shaking your head right now, aren't you?
Yeah. Because
I know you just went to low-hanging kiwi fruit and punched in like the brand name for this thing, and turned up for Australia, and you turned up something like what, 350 systems?
Yeah, at least 350 internet-facing, like, and that's a 10-second, well, yeah, even faster than that search. So it's just not good.
Any dot mills?
I couldn't possibly say. I'm sure they'll be duly reported to your cert.
Exactly. Right. Now here's just one of those stories that has a surprising statistic in it. It turns out that it's mainstream websites, not those crappy little lyrics websites and whatever, that actually host the majority of malware.
Yeah, although it would be interesting to see what the breakdown of actually how it's being hosted, like whether it's ad networks or whether it's actual attacks on mainstream sites. I mean, things like, bodging iframes into forums or message boards or things on mainstream sites or advertising networks. I mean, that's kind of what I would imagine more than, direct CMS ownage of CNN.com or whatever.
No, but I guess the point is that what they're saying is you're more likely to encounter malware by visiting mainstream sites than you are by visiting anywhere else, which makes sense because the bad guys are going to target where where their targets go.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, totally agree. And the average consumer who gets owned really doesn't care exactly why. What technical piece of infrastructure owned them. Right, the fact is they went to a mainstream site and they got popped. Is the important thing for them. I was interested in these numbers, actually. I mean, something like that it was such a large amount. This report also suggested that 87% of exploits they looked at in this particular survey were the fault of Java.
Yeah, well, I'm shocked.
Newsflash.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, I'm going to make a shocked face right now.
Yes, that's it. I'm picturing something like Monk's Scream. Something like that, anyway. Now, this next story is about a bit of research. It comes to us via SC Magazine. And I love research like this because occasionally a researcher will just go after something that's like a pet peeve, or just something a little bit obscure. And this dude has done a lot of research into hashing algorithms.
Yeah, so there's this kind of computational complexity attack where you craft input data such that it's going to hit the worst case of the algorithm. I mean, this is a sort of a class of bug that's long been the sort of thing that computer science students are made to wrangle for the professor's sadistic glee. But actually, these things do work in the real world. So you can craft data. In this particular case, we're talking about using hash collisions to make specifically tree data structures, become worst case linear traversal rather than nicely, balanced trees or whatever. And, this is a thing that, you can take down somebody's website with it. No one cares, that it is, an interesting computational complexity attack rather than just straight DOS. But yeah, if you're going to use, hash structures in your favorite programming language, you just kind of expect them to work. You don't stop to think, well, how are they actually implemented in their guts? There's the trade-off between speed and complexity and resistance to hash collisions. And so it's a very interesting line of research. And it's, I think something that, as the cheap SQL injection and the cheap cross-site scripting bugs fade out, this kind of bug class is going to be something that will keep researchers busy for a long time in the future, I think.
Yeah, now if you click through to the story on this, it's called Crypto Collisions Cause Denial of Service in Major Hashes. It's one of Darren's stories as well, again. And he's embedded a YouTube clip of the entire presentation. So if that's something that floats your boat, smokes your goat, go ahead and watch it.
Did you say smokes your goat?
Yes, I did.
Sure, I don't know what you do up there in wherever it is that you live, but
there's some good goats up here, let me tell you. Now a couple of UK Anons who were ringleaders in the whole attack against PayPal as part of Operation Payback in the pound me in the ass.
Yeah,
well, one of them anyway.
Do you think going to jail for DDoS really is a thing that should happen?
Especially a politically motivated DDoS. How about fine the crap out of the guy? Make him paint roadside rocks orange,
Sentence him
to annoying community service work where he goes and has to sell secondhand clothes for a charity and be around all the old ladies who smell like dead skin. That to him. Not jail. Come on.
Yeah, it's frustrating to see the kind of, what seems to be a complete lack of correspondence between the punishment and the crime. It's kind of depressing.
If they're getting 18 months in the UK, can you imagine what the sentences in the US are going to look like?
Well, this is exactly the problem, because there's plenty of other people who are in that same op that are, you know, facing prosecution in the US, and they're talking like years in jail for throwing a few packets around.
15 years they're talking about, but none of them are sought to profit from this. So, you know, PayPal suffered no loss, yada, yada. Although they're probably going to say, you know, it cost them $6 trillion, you know.
Yeah,
because their blog was down for 10 seconds, you know.
I mean, they're claiming, what, $5.2 million is what it cost them, which includes, like, upgrading their routers to have a bigger pipe. Like, really? Like, let's face it, PayPal, right, you're a big company. You're in the middle of the, you know,
internet, DDoS mitigation is something you kind of should have been doing beforehand.
Well, yeah. And, you know, if a bunch of, you know, teenage kids, like 14 teenage kids.
Using Loic
can take down your system, like really, who's really?
But they didn't even take them down. They took down their blog. For like a couple of hours. They did not take them down.
Yeah. You know, really, like.
So this is like jail time for attempted DDoS, you know? Like,
what, yeah.
Anyway.
It does. It makes me kind of cranky, you know? If someone goes down to PayPal's headquarters and defaces the sign out the front of their office, they're not going to get 15 years in jail, you know?
Interesting little write-up here about how the RSA attackers, the guys who, you know, got into RSA, apparently China as well. Got into RSA, stole all those seed token, the token seed values. It's long been thought that this was an attack, first stage of an attack that was going after Lockheed Martin. Although people are saying, you know, the Lockheed Martin attack did not succeed. And there's a nice big write-up here about how they swung and missed.
Yeah, and you know... I would love to see a bunch of detail about exactly what they spotted and, you know, the indicators of compromise and the kind of details that that would float my boat or smoke my goat or whatever the expression is around here. But and no one's going to come out and say that, sadly. But yeah, it's an interesting article. It does kind of describe a little bit of the rationale that the Lockheed security guys went through, like detecting anomalous use of legitimate credentials via VPN and then seeing authentication failures inside the network, and then letting the guys stay in for a bit to try and contain them, figure out what they're doing, figure out what other bits of the network they may already be in, which is, you know, what you would expect to happen. And, you know, I would like to believe that, you know, people were competent and doing a good job. And this is, you know, sort of, there's a slight seed of hope that maybe there is some competence there. So that's good, I suppose.
So I guess the Chinese attackers will just have to wait a couple of years until they develop some new attack techniques before they can steal Lockheed's plans for its death ray. the chemical that turns us all into zombies.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're working on something like that, you know?
Probably, yeah.
Here
probably.
Is a compound that will turn babies inside out within 3 seconds.
Kaploosh.
Yes, and they raise their glasses. To human misery!
hey there, Mill Industrial Baby Killers. How you doing?
Hey, nice to see you. Good to be back. Now, there's been some... Oh, I love this. Barracuda Networks, they make a whole bunch of, you know, spam filters and whatnot, you know, appliancey sort of shit. They've got some... They apparently a whole bunch of their... Oh, VPNs as well. A whole bunch of their devices are shipping with, like, these default accounts, which are supposed to be IP-restricted, like they're hidden default accounts that are supposed to be IP-restricted to Barracuda's, like, HQ. And guess what?
They're not. I had a jolly lull at this. There's SSH keys that are deployed on the Barracuda appliance. And of course, when you buy a Barracuda spam filtering gateway, typically you're going to put it in front of your mail server, so probably on the internet. And if you don't firewall it properly, then like having open SSH to the internet would be a thing that could happen. Anyway, these are meant to be access listed to a bunch of addresses that are off, as you say, at Barracuda HQ. And there's a number of, well, there's at least a network in that list that it doesn't belong to Barracuda. Like, it's some hosting company, you know, that just sells boxes to people. Now, I think the plausible explanation for this is that once upon a time before Barracuda was Barracuda, like when they were owned by somebody else or before they sold out or whatever, that network probably did belong to them, and it's just never been taken out. But it's still hilariously funny. The guy who's buying, you know, like virtual hosting in the right net block right now, like he could have a whole bunch of fun. Like the cost, the value of his hosting just you know, got a little bit better.
I think I know some Eastern European gentlemen who might like to have a word.
Yeah, like, he could certainly resell that service for a few pretty pennies or pretty rubles.
Staying with Failkit, Juniper's having some issues, some DOS potential DOS conditions in Junos.
Yeah, there's some kind of TCP denial of service that's affects, you know, until very recent Junos, which lets you, you know, send a nasty packet or a couple of packets to a Juniper router, and it'll just go ahead and reboot, which, you know, given that, well, say the entire New Zealand internet runs off a couple of, you know, tiny Junipers, you know, that could be a bit of a problem. So, you know, I hope everybody who looks after big Junos routers can schedule yourself an outage and upgrade your Junos.
Excellent. Now, obviously, the biggest story to break within our field over summer was the really, really tragic death of Aaron Swartz, who, you know, I mean, you're listening to this podcast right now. He is one of dudes who created RSS at age 14. You know, he was one of those very, very smart young guys. He's also a guy that we'd mentioned on the show a few times because he was facing charges for breaking into, like, basically a cupboard at MIT to siphon down, you know, journal articles and whatnot. This is part of his big information should be free thing. I think at the time you and I both said, well, that is a step too far. And we both agreed that he had done something wrong. Now, what we didn't know at the time is that the prosecutors in that case, or I can't actually remember if we discussed it in these terms, but the prosecutors in that case were going for something like 35 years in prison for Aaron Swartz. And a lot of people are saying that really pushed him to kill himself. But I mean, the whole thing, just miserable, isn't it?
It really is. It's absolutely tragic, eh? And the you know, the more you hear about the specifics of the story, the kind of the worse it sounds. I saw Tim Berners-Lee gave a keynote at LinuxConf AU in Canberra last week, which I went to, and he was talking for a bit of that about Aaron Swartz and about the, you know, some of the circumstances leading up to his death. And he hadn't really talked about it much in public, I guess, previously, because, you know, he was planning on testifying and, you know, not trying to talk about it in public too much until then. But I mean, some of the specifics of the case, like, for example, Aaron apparently, you know, the cabinet where he put his laptop or secreted the machine to get access to, you know, to download these documents, is in a public access area of the building, and in a, you know, area that, you know, it's not unrealistic that to expect that to happen. Like, the, you know, certainly the MIT people considered that a public access area of the network, and he was a, you know, visiting friend of the MIT, you know, being from Harvard and things like that. And it'd be like, the more you hear about it, just the more, you know, the less worse it sounds. And especially when, you know, you hear that the JSTOR, the people he was getting the documents from, you know, they weren't really keen on prosecuting, and, you know, certainly members of the MIT faculty.
But it's, you know, it's the way they went after
distraught
him.
About it.
It's the way they went after him. The fact that, you know, they went after him under the computer, you know, Misuse and Fraud Act or whatever, where really the cupboard thing wouldn't have even been trespass. I think you and I had a problem with that because it was an in-principle thing, which is like, you cannot expect not to get in trouble when you escalate things to that point. But being in trouble and getting a slap and a $200 fine is a little bit different than looking at 35 years in prison. I mean, what are these guys thinking?
Well, exactly. Federal, like, actual felony crimes, which in the US, you know, is a big deal. If you want to travel overseas, you want to be an entrepreneur, you know, you have a bright future ahead of you, having a, you know, a felony conviction, taking a, you know, a plea bargain, like, if you get offered 35 years and the pound me in the ass, or, you know, a plea bargain and, you know, some months, which I think was one of the things they were offering, you're still a felon, right? You still have, you know, all these extra consequences for the rest of your life. And to be staring down the barrel of that, and the man, as I gather, you know, he was 2 years into this process, had run out of money. You know, you could really see how that the weight of that would you know, come down on top of you.
I mean, but at the end of the day, we do not know if it was this prosecution that caused him to suicide. I understand he'd had problems with depression as well. You know, it's impossible for us to know how much of a factor it was. But what we can say is, in retrospect, is it may have been a factor. And at the end of the day, it means that America has essentially robbed itself of someone who, by the age 14, had been instrumental in creating something as widely adopted as RSS, you know, at age 14, who was doing some very interesting things with community action and the nexus between community action and technology. You know, this is someone who, had he lived a full life, I'm guessing, would have done some incredible things. So yeah, America has, through its own actions as a system, denied itself this person. And that's just sad. That's sad for everyone. And you just got to think, let's hope this prosecutor falls over and hurts himself.
Stubs his toe with some vigor,
With a chainsaw.
It is very sad. And hopefully some good comes of it. Hopefully we see, you know, some effort. There are already law changes being proposed in Aaron's name that would try and claw back some of the crazy around computer crime laws. I mean, you know, violating a website terms and conditions or, you know, a EULA or something, right? That shouldn't be a felony crime. Mm. That's a contract dispute, right? And clawing back some of that crazy, hopefully, you know, maybe we get that out of this. And even then, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't make it better. But, you know, maybe it won't happen to, you know, the next guy or the, you know, the non-kids who are being done for the PayPal thing, you know?
Well, that was cheery. I feel like we should have a bit of a chat about jelly bean shitting unicorns or something before yeah. we wrap it up. But actually, that is it for the week's news, Adam. We've gone massively over time, but it's great to be back. It's great to chat to you again, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to be back in the saddle and to offer opinions on the internet to people.
Yep, we ran a bit over time there. Sorry about that, but we had a lot to catch up on. That was Adam Boileau. With the first look at the security news headlines in Risky Business for 2013. Next up, it is time for this week's feature interview with Casey Ellis. By now, most people in InfoSec are familiar with the concept of a bug bounty program. Google, Facebook, and other online giants will pay you good money if you can find a security bug in their systems. In terms of QA bang for buck, these programs work extremely well. But what if you're not Google or Facebook? What if you're not an online behemoth? How can you run a bug bounty program? Well, that's a problem that Casey has sought to solve through his new website and business, bugcrowd.com. These guys are doing outsourced bug bounty management. He joined me via Skype for this interview.
I mean, the way we pitch it to people is that we run managed bug bounties. We run two models of bounty. One is, you know, kind of your traditional, call it Google style model, where we act as a clearinghouse for disclosures. So we manage receiving the vulnerability, validating it, managing the payment to the tester, and then obviously communicating it to the client and answering any questions they might have. That's one side. The other side is more of the process that we put together to answer some of the objections that people have to setting these things up, and that's a time-boxed model where basically the customer puts together a reward pool. We structure rewards that are available to the crowd. And then we set a time for testing to start and finish. At the end of that time, we do the same thing. We validate the results and assign rewards to the testers based on what they've submitted.
Okay, so let's just walk through this first scenario, the Google scenario. Sure. Say I'm one of the major banks here in Australia and I think, gee, it'd be really nice to get some free QA, or it would be nice if there was a process for people to report bugs to me. So what you're essentially doing is you're just an outsourced sort of cert that deals only in vulnerabilities affecting, you know, my bank's website. Is that
correct?
Right?
That's exactly right, yes.
So is there any payment involved to the people who found the bugs in that scenario, or this is purely just about handling the interaction?
No, there's payment involved. We are looking into doing a voluntary disclosure program just in general, but for the purpose of what we're talking about, which is the commercial model, we would speak to the client and get from them what they would like to pay per vulnerability, and obviously make that fairly clear to the people that were involved in testing before they submitted, because those are the sorts of things you want to make sure are clear up front.
Okay, now how is this different from the second model, though, where you've actually got a time window testing? Is that the only difference? So what you're doing is you're actually setting up a testing window, and I believe also that people who are interested in finding bugs can register with you guys. Correct. So I'm guessing you get a new client. I'm, you know, Acme Bank. I come to you and go, look, I want you to cut loose your minions of bug hunters against my system, but I want you to do it on Tuesday between 2 p.m. and 8 p.m.
Sure. So the main reason that we put together the time-boxed model, the way this all came about is, you know, doing a fair bit of work around penetration testing in my previous life and previous business, having discussions with lots of different people that have web apps as a core element of their business, and bug bounty started to come up quite frequently in conversation. And I started asking the question, you know, if you guys think this is such a great idea, what's stopping you from doing it? And there was a consistent set of issues that came up. One of them was how do we cap the cost? So how do we manage, you know, if we're going to undertake something like this, how do we do it in a way where, you know, if it turns out we've got 100 million bugs in our application, which probably the cost would be the least of their problems at that point. But if that was the case, you know, how can we make sure that we're managing, you know, the kind of money that we're going to be spending on this? And the way we came up with doing that is this time box method. So instead of it being an open thing where we're paying for bugs as we come in, there is a reward pool, and the testers effectively compete for that for a piece of that reward pool.
So how many testers do you actually have registered with you at the moment, and what is a typical payment for a bug?
Sure. At the moment, we've got 1,200 that have signed up. Basically,
that's quite a few, Casey. How did you manage that?
Well, I mean, I've been in the industry for a number of years now, as has Serge, my co-founder, and I've been sort of reasonably deliberate about networking with people and just, you know, effectively making friends in the industry.
That's a lot of friends, man.
Yeah, I'd not say I've got 1,200 friends in the industry, but when I announced, yeah, we're gonna do this managed bug bounty thing, the people that knew me got pretty excited about it and started talking about it, and it kind of went from there. So we had a nice little kick early on. We did a little, you know, kind of a tester drive, a tester sign up drive over Christmas as well, which boosted the numbers a bit too.
And have you been able to throw these guys at any target yet?
Yeah, so what we've done, our initial bounty was a proof of concept that we ran on just a Rails app that I had developed probably 2 years ago that I knew was reasonably robust, but I hadn't looked at from a security point of view for a little while, so I figured there'd probably be some good findings in there. So we threw up a small amount and had 80 people participate in that. We ended up with 15 unique findings on the application, ranging from fairly simple vulnerabilities to a couple of quite interesting ones. We've run our first, call it decent sized paid time box bounty that completed, that closed off about a fortnight ago. I can't obviously go into detail about that because it's a client, but.
So you can't tell us that it was.
I can't tell you it was. No. But, it was one of those things because if you signed up as a tester, you'll find out who it is and you can participate, but we have a responsibility to try and, you know, protect the client's confidentiality.
Now, how many people, I'm guessing you send out an email to all of your testers and say, go nuts, here's the time window, you know, have as much fun with it as you want. You're competing for this pool of cash.
Yep,
how many people actually participated in that first shot with the client that may not be named?
Sure. In that paid bounty, we had about 1,200 that the email went out to at the time. And from what we can tell, we're still waiting on a little bit more data from that. But from what we can tell, we had about 500 participate, ranging in, you know, levels from just having a bit of a poke around and then stopping to people that actually put a decent chunk of time into it.
And what sort of money did they get paid for the – what was the biggest single payment made?
$1,250 was the first prize. So the way we divvy out our prizes when we do a reward pool, what we want to do is incentivize coverage as well as people going after kind of call it creative stuff. So we have first, second, and third prize which is judged by us and rewarded based on the creativity or severity of a finding. And then apart from that, the remainder of the pool is a fixed price per bug, or if there's a lot of findings, it's the remainder of the pool divided by the number of valid bugs that were found. That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's no guarantee that if you submit a bug that you will actually get paid.
No, that's correct. And I mean, that's the same with the bug bounty models that exist today. So the one circumstance where you can submit a bug and not get paid is if someone has already submitted it previously. So there is a little bit of, you know, first in, best dressed. That's just the nature of the model. You know, obviously we'd like to be able to reward everyone with cash, but we can't.
Now, also, I imagine that there's some pretty complicated legal agreements in place, not only between you and your customers, but between you and your testers, because I'd imagine you might, I mean, with 1,200 people registered, you're going to have a problem at some point with someone who gets a bit overzealous.
Yeah, correct. So in terms of what we've got in place between us and the client, you know, obviously we're in beta at the moment and we make that fairly clear. We've done as much, you know, risk assessment and you know, tumble drying of the business model and the delivery model to make sure the risks are as low as possible. But we do tell the client, you know, same as if you're doing a penetration test, you go out there and say, all right, we're going to avoid causing any issues, but if they do happen, then you can't, or that you don't hold us accountable to that, or hold us liable for that rather.
And have you had any dramas with you know, some of your testers being a little bit too keen?
So far, no. It's been everyone's been very well behaved. I mean, we make it quite clear to them what's okay and what's not. And obviously, as we do more and more of these things, we're refining and adding and subtracting and making it more clear. We haven't had a site go down from testing yet. And everyone's behaving themselves very well.
Now, in conversations that I've had with you, you've described this as being freakily good QA spend in terms of bang for buck. I mean, how do you actually quantify that?
Well, look, I mean, in terms of...
Let me rephrase it. I mean, how much is a timed window sort of attack likely to cost an organization? You know, me, Acme Bank, I come to you, I say, I want your testers to have a look at this. How much is it going to cost me?
In terms of the way we structure the pricing and we structure the reward pool, we recommend to the client that they put a reward pool out to the market that kind of matches the value of the target, so to speak. So if it's a bank, you know, you wouldn't want a bank going out and saying, hey, here's $5,000, go have a look at our stuff, because you would expect a bank to value what's being tested more than that. For startups, I mean, we've set a baseline bounty pool of $5,000, which is what we recommend for startups, e-commerce businesses, you know, people that are at that level. But we're about to kick off a bounty in a week or two's time that'll have a pool of $10,000, and it's steadily climbing north as we start to get into bigger and more established customers.
And where do you get your cash from out of this? I mean, do you guys just take a percentage of the pool, or?
Yeah, so the way our model is that we take a cut of the, we charge rather a percentage of the reward pool.
No, you take a cut, man. It's Casey's Casino pretty much. You know, well, this is.
We actually add it on top of the reward pool. But, well, you know, you got to feed the family, right?
Now, just back on that value for money thing, you know, you say it is really good value for money. I mean, how do you quantify that? Is that just because, I mean, you know, obviously no one's advocating that this replaces a pen test. This is just sort of supplementary. And, you know, they might find stuff that your pen test guys might miss. But, I mean, you know, I'm guessing you're saying it's value for money because they really do find stuff that otherwise would go unnoticed. And if you work it out on an hourly rate, that would have... You know, the number of hours that's gone into finding those problems, it's pretty good. I mean, is that the justification? Or?
That's part of it. I mean, obviously you can't do a one-to-one from an hourly rate point of view, because the penetration testers, you know, following a methodology and all those sorts of things, which a lot of our testers have indicated they are doing as well. But, you know, we can't sort of say things that we can't stand behind like that. Probably more from the point of view of the number of findings that we get out of these things, and the depth of the findings. You know, as an example, each bounty that we've run so far has come up with a third party 0 day. So something that has been, you know, a system that's been fully patched and they found a vulnerability in third party software that is, you know, undisclosed as far as we can tell and hasn't been patched. And that doesn't happen very often in a pen test. It does happen. In terms of whether people actually find that or not, I know it does happen, but it's, you know, 3 for 3 gives us a pretty good feeling for the level of depth that we're getting out of this type of approach.
Now, what's the response from the enterprise end of the market? I know that your first, you know, paying customer was more of a startup technology-based, you know, business.
Sure.
You know, when you're walking into a boardroom and you're pitching this to a bunch of people who tend to play it safe when it comes to who they do business with. We're talking government departments, financial institutions. What's the response been like from them?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that we've put in place, and that was another one, going back to what I was saying before about the consistent objections to people actually starting up their own bug bounty program. There was a couple of things in terms of, okay, how do we stop testing if we need to? How do we tell which traffic that we're seeing that looks bad is malicious or is well-intentioned and is coming from a bug bounty tester? What we've put together is a thing which we call crowd control, which is basically we proxy all of the testing through our infrastructure. So it's got a common point of origin, and that we have a level of control over when, you know, where the testers are able to go. And if obviously the client needs to hit the big red button for whatever reason, we're able to do that.
So what we go and like if I'm a tester, I VPN into your boxes, do I, and then bounce out from there, or how does it work?
Essentially, yes.
Okay, so it's not like you've set up shell accounts or something. It's like just a what?
It's a VPN. I mean, it's a tunnel, effectively.
Yeah. Cool.
So that actually makes it a lot more palatable to the enterprise guys. I mean, if it really depends on how it's couched. If we go in there and say, hey, we're going to unleash a bunch of hackers onto your sites and sort of kick it off like that, it tends to get things started off on the wrong foot. But, you know, in terms of, okay, here's some of the things that we've put in place to try and mitigate the risks that are involved. Here's some of the ways that we're incentivizing the crowd to do the right thing. Here's the level of control that we're able to kind of exert over this when it's in progress. And, you know, then the other side of it is, hey, here's the bang for buck that you're getting out of it. So maybe factor that in when you're assessing the risk of it all.
Sounds totally legit. Casey Ellis, we wish you and your army of hacker minions all the best with this new venture.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Casey Ellis there with a chat about bugcrowd.com. Now, also, one thing to know is that these guys do free bounty programs for charitable organizations. And you know what? If you're looking to get into the security business, and this is a question I get asked quite a lot, you know, particularly in testing, you should go and register with bugcrowd.com and, you know, try your skills out on a few of their targets. I mean, you'll get some excellent real life experience. And Casey's doing some really interesting things with kudos points on the website that, you know, that mean you can build yourself a bit of a reputation as a good tester. And that's never going to be a bad thing on ZResume. Okay, it's time for this week's sponsor interview now. And this week's show is brought to you by Adobe. Adobe's Director of Product Security and Privacy, Brad Arkin, is joining us to talk about a couple of things. Regular listeners would have followed Adobe's hassle last year with a Russian firm, Group IB, which claimed to have a zero-day in Acrobat Reader. Now, we're talking about a full sandbox bypass, bad, bad, bad bug. But certain elements of their story didn't stack up. Now, it's been a few months, and Brad is now confident the whole thing was a wind-up. Here's what he had to say.
So the short version is, I'd like to call bullshit.
So you're officially calling bullshit now, because you're a little bit nervous about doing that last year, just in case.
We're highly reluctant to ever do that, but in this case, we feel like after exhaustive analysis, that's the right conclusion. So to get a little more detailed here, we've had a 60,000 word count conversation over email with multiple parties related to the Group IB universe around this.
Could you serialize it and turn it into a thriller, or is it?
We've done word clouds and presented it at a conference already, so it's entertaining. We've called in Russian language experts. We've had many phone calls, and so the bottom line is we are pretty confident there never was a sandbox bypass, which is what made the whole thing so exciting. And there may or may not have been a bug that worked against Reader 10, but the only sample that we have is a bug not in the sandbox itself, but just something that triggers a crash in Reader 10.1.4 on XP only. And it's also not clear that that bug was ever in the possession of Group IB, but it did belong to a person who had an unclear relationship with Group IB. And so we didn't get a sample of it until a week after we shipped our update for 10.1.5 in January. And 10.1.5 resolves the issue. And so there never was a sandbox bypass. The crash bug in version 10 only has been resolved in January. We've also confirmed that the videos that were posted online were doctored and do not represent truthfully what they appear to present. And so from our perspective, anything that was real has been fixed. Most of the stuff wasn't real, and it's over. So we've closed the books on that one.
Okay. But you say a 60,000 word email chain. How much dicking around did this really involve? Because it sounds like it was, you know, a fair bit of dicking.
Yeah, we treated it as credible. And anytime anyone approaches us offering to share information to help us make things safer for our customers, we jump at the chance. And you know, we've interacted with people who have said, we have a bug, we will not share it with you. And we say, okay, well, you don't have to, but we'd love to change your mind to talk about it. And so that happens. Usually they'll tell the world, and then we get in touch and say, hey, we noticed, by the way. And then they'll write back and say, yep, it's true. And we'll say, well, can we have a copy? And they'll say no.
Yeah.
And we get that. You know, people, they have their own choices. They can do what they want. But these guys were saying, oh, yeah, it's real. We've got it. We'll send it to you tomorrow. We'll send it to you next week. Oh, it's at the office. We'll send it to you on Monday.
My dog ate it.
And that happened time after time after time after time after time. And it was a fascinating experience. So actually this week, Dave Leno and Karthik Raman from the team gave a presentation at the Kaspersky SAS conference, where the whole presentation was about this incident and talking about the back and forth and, you know, how we approached it and what our style is in situations like this. And, you know, it's not the only Phantom O-Day situation that's happened before. So it went over well for the audience there. People learned a lot.
Rightio, now I also believe that you guys, I mean, we've heard a lot about, you know, spearfishing attacks involving flash objects, you know, doing weird stuff like being embedded in Word documents and stuff. I understand that this is an exploitation path you guys are trying to address at the moment. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we've done some analysis on this, and it's actually pretty interesting because if you look at the, you know, when a zero day happens, there's the initial sample that was used for the first attack, and then lots of other bad guys will take that sample and adapt it for other purposes. And so that's how an APT attack will end up in a crime pack, or, you know, used in some other type of attack. And so, but when you look at the actual initial sample for Flash Player O-Days, what we found is that back in 2009, 2010, there was a handful that were malicious Flash Player content embedded in PDFs. And then when we shipped the sandbox in Reader 10, the bad guys migrated to putting malicious Flash into Microsoft Office documents. And so primarily Word docs and Excel. And the famous one here is the RSA attack was a Flash object inside of a Excel file. And then what we were looking at is that there's once these attacks are created, then other people will manipulate the attacks and tweak them so that they'll work in the browser, they'll work somewhere else. But the initial attack vector is always that Office file format, because that allows them to attach it to an email and use it as a targeted email-based.
Can I just ask at this point why you know, why in the name of holy hell you would actually want to embed a Flash object in a Word document in the first place?
I don't know. You know, honestly, I've never seen any legitimate use cases for that. Sometimes you could imagine somebody with a fancy PowerPoint deck that would have some fancy animation in it. I talked to a person who sits on the email exchange for a very large network, and he said they went and looked at a years of Office file formats that had Swift inside, and they were either malicious or benign, but not for work purposes. And so these are things like Elf bowling games pasted into an Excel file.
So like Easter eggs and stuff, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, but hang on. So is this a Microsoft decision that results in these things being in there, or is this an Adobe? I mean, you guys would have had to collaborate to make that work, right?
No. So the way it works is you can put you can put objects into Word docs that will then render using the IE rendering engine.
Right.
And if IE has plugins, then it'll use the plugins to render it. And so since Flash Player is a plugin for IE, if you have that on the machine, that's how it'll work. And what's really
okay,
useful
so, so unless you got, but hang on, if won't that, won't you have to actually punch through the sandbox anyway, like in Flash Player, like even if it's in a Word document, if it's rendering through IE and the plugin's the latest sandbox plugin, I mean, you should be okay, right?
Aha. So
yes, this is the interesting
when
bit.
When you double click a Office file document in an email, then the way it renders is it's loading it off the file system, and so it's as if you double clicked it from your own file hierarchy.
Okay, so now you're in like the trusted zone, not the internet zone or whatever, right?
Yeah. And so now whatever precautions you might have in place for whichever version of IE you're using, like IE protected mode and IE 7 and later. You're not getting the benefit of that when you're doing it from the file system. And so you can get around these protections in IE, but it's a hurdle and it's harder. And so the bad guys, you know, it's most attractive to do it off the file system in a Word doc or an Excel file. And so the other thing is that in Office 2010 and later, there's you know, view mode and things that make it a lot harder to carry out these types of attacks, but a lot of attractive targets are running Office 2007 or earlier. And so that's another you know, missed opportunity basically for the defenders.
Back to what it is that you guys are exactly doing about it, now that I've got you know, a slightly better understanding of how why it's appealing to do it that way in the first place. What do you do to fix that?
So basically, you can't just disable this ability without disabling Flash Player plugin altogether. And so if people want Flash Player plugin for internet content, but they don't want it for office content, there's no real easy way to do that. So
yeah.
What we ended up doing is we've got, it's in beta now. It's going to be moving into the production release very soon. And it's basically a click through. So, you know, click to Flash kind of user interface. So any file format, or sorry, any Swift object inside of a Microsoft Office file, instead of rendering when you load the document, it'll instead give you a dialog box that says, this contains active content from a potentially untrusted source. Do you want to execute yes or no? And it'll have no as the default, and it'll say recommended next to that. And so if the user takes no action, then the Swift object won't render. If the user reads it and then doesn't do anything, it won't render. If they read it and click OK, then it'll turn off the Swift object.
So hang on, you have to actually click on the Swift object first to bring up that dialog, or will it just pop up as soon as you load the file?
Instead of, so in the old days, you would get your Elf Bowling or whatever thing would pop up and start playing right away. And so instead of seeing that, you'll see the dialog box in a corner in the page somewhere. And then if you ignore it, no execution. If you click OK, it'll just exit. And then if you change the choice from no to yes, I want to execute, and you change it from the recommended to the not recommended, and then hit OK, then it'll render.
Right.
So what we're hoping now, and we've seen this happen with other parts of functionality, that once we put it behind a one-click surface, that hurdle, even though it doesn't seem like all that much, it's a huge obstacle for the bad guys in terms of their investment, because they now need to do social engineering. They need to figure out a way to get you to click it. And usually what we've seen is that if you're going to go to that much effort, you might as well send somebody an exe inside of a zip or something like that, because the success rate is going to be just as high.
But I mean, that said, isn't it the case that most users are just like, you know, if you can dress it up as like, in order to view this content, you must click allow. I mean, then, you know, they're going to click allow.
Yeah, users will. But what we've seen is that in order to do the social engineering to compel the user to take that action, now it has to be localized in the right language. There's more chance for something weird to be there that'll tip people off. And so for the high-end attacks, what we've seen is that, you know, putting something behind a, like in Reader, we call it the yellow bar. And so we'll put content behind the yellow bar so it doesn't execute with a zero-click experience anymore. And then the bad guys just move off it because they don't want to fool around with the social engineering. So it may be effective in this case. We hope it will. If anything else, it'll at least be a speed bump and raise the cost for the attackers. But it's just one of the little things that we're doing to try to make Flash Player less attractive as an attack vector. And because it is a chunk of functionality that is not the primary use case for the product, then it's something that we're making less convenient, and we're hoping that'll be less convenient for the attackers as well.
All right. Well, Brad Arkin, thank you very much for joining us and letting us know what you've been doing over in the United States this winter.
All right. Thanks, Patrick.
That was Brad Arkin rounding up this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. It is good to be back in the Risky Business chair. This week's track is by a local band here in Byron called Firewalk, and that's fire spelled F-Y-A-H. It's called All My Life, and I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Flexibility can never get crushed, yeah. Greedy man, you're not enough.
crime, but I'm back, somebody hits out of crime. Hey, angle of the mind, time, burning in the fire, that you got the ring, means unified. Look at the time, running in a fire that deep down the ring is lifted up.